Hello, lovely True Crime Dimes. You might have deduced from its title and the fact that it's a true crime podcast that the show will cover potentially upsetting content. In addition to detailed accounts of all manner of horrendous acts, this podcast will also entail the vital and varied use of curse words, BIPOC allyship, love for the LGBTQ plus community, using people's correct pronouns, and other pretty liberal shit. If any of that's gonna upset you, exit now. This is Trigger Warning, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Jen O'Malley, and you've been warned. Harvey Miguel Robinson's string of rapes and murders began when he was 17 years old, making him one of the youngest serial killers in American history. Described as cunning and manipulative, he was first arrested at the age of 9. When he was 14, his teacher, pregnant with twins, was afraid of Harvey and asked for a social worker to be present whenever he was in her class. Harvey got into a physical fight with the man. At some point, Harvey was put into classes for the socially and emotionally disturbed. On Wednesday, August 5th, 1992, around 12:30 in the morning, Joan Burghart called the police to report a burglary at 1430 East Gordon Street in Allentown, Pennsylvania, her one-bedroom first-floor apartment where she lived alone. The 29-year-old had left around 11 p.m. to take a friend home, and in that time, someone had entered her apartment and stolen $40 to $50 cash that was in her bedroom. Joan told police that a fan, which she left on before leaving the apartment, had been turned off, the patio door she had left open was closed, and the screen on the door, which was locked, had been ripped about 6 to 8 inches, just enough to get a hand through, near the locking mechanism. 4 days later, on the morning of Sunday, August 9th, Joan's neighbor called police to complain that Joan's stereo had been on for 3 days and nights, no one answered the doorbell, the screen had been out of the window for 3 nights, and during one of those nights, it had sounded like someone was beating Joan up, hitting the walls and screaming. Wow. Nice how the neighbor waited until the stereo pissed them off instead of calling the cops when it sounded like someone was being beaten. Great job. When police arrived this time, both the front door and patio door were locked. At the front exterior of the apartment, the window was open and its screen was propped up against the building. At the rear exterior, the window was open, but its screen was lying on the ground. The screen on the patio door was closed, but not locked, and had a cut about 6 to 8 inches long near the handle. I believe that this was the same cut from the earlier break-in. Once police entered Joan's apartment, they found her dead body face down on the floor in front of her sofa. There was blood all over the floor, couch, and walls. She was wearing a sleep shirt and a pair of jockey shorts, like boy briefs, that had been ripped at the crotch and pulled up, leaving her naked from the hips down. Her autopsy revealed that Joan had been sexually assaulted and bludgeoned to death by 37 individual blunt force injuries to her scalp, causing extensive skull fractures and damage to the brain. The weapon was a circular, cylindrical instrument about 1/2 to 3/4 inches in diameter with a smooth surface and about 10 to 20 inches long. The force of the blows was so deliberate and tremendous that, as the instrument came down, it embedded hair between the fracture and skull. Joan had defensive injuries on both hands. A pair of black shorts were found on the floor of her bedroom, with blood and white stains on them. A peach-colored shirt was on her closet door, and on it was a lot of blood and distinctive patterns that appeared to have been made by swipe marks from whatever was used as the murder weapon. Testing determined that the shorts had seminal stains on the outside, as though someone had ejaculated into them, and the DNA was later matched to Harvey. Harvey was arrested for an unrelated crime on Wednesday, September 23, 1992, and sent to a juvenile facility until he was released on Friday, May 14, 1993. Around 6:45 a.m. on Wednesday, June 9, 1993, less than a quarter of a mile away from Joan's apartment, police responded to a missing person call at 1058 East Gordon Street. When the typically punctual newspaper delivery girl hadn't shown up, a resident became concerned. Her newspaper cart was left unattended for approximately 30 minutes in front of a neighbor's house. Police found the newspaper cart half-filled and a Walkman radio and its headset separated from each other on the ground between two houses, as well as finger streaks on the windowpane of the door to a nearby garage. Police concluded that there'd been a struggle and 15-year-old Charlotte Schmoyer had been abducted. While searching a heavily wooded area at Allentown's East Side Reservoir later that day, police followed a bloody trail that led them to Charlotte's body. She'd been covered by logs. Her sweatshirt was slightly pulled up. Her sweatpants and underwear had been pulled down toward her knees. She had a large, gaping wound in her throat, separate stab wounds below that gash, multiple stab wounds on her back, and a patterned bruise on the right side of her cheek. Her autopsy revealed 22 stab wounds, 16 in the back, including 7 that were fatal, and 6 in the front area of the neck, of which any combination would have been fatal. In addition, there were cutting and scraping wounds in the neck area, indicating they were inflicted while Charlotte was conscious with her neck bent down as a protective measure, and 7 more cuts to the back of the sweatshirt, indicating that some struggle occurred since the sweatshirt was cut but her body was not. The weapon was a single-edged knife about 4 inches long. At least 2 of the wounds were up to the hilt of the blade. I want to note here that I'm going to change a phrase moving forward. The court documents for these crimes state that the victims had intercourse shortly before death, which makes me wildly uncomfortable. I understand why it's said that way, because scientific testing doesn't necessarily indicate the context of a sex act, and they have to deal in facts. However, these people were raped, and so I'm going to say that or sexually assaulted for the rest of the episode. That being said, Charlotte was raped. DNA that would later be matched to Harvey was found on her vaginal swab. His blood was found on Charlotte's sweatshirt and sweatpants, along the trail leading to her body, and on leaves at the crime scene near her head. On the night of Monday, June 28, 1993, 38-year-old Denise Sam Calley was alone at the home she shared with her husband at 1141 East Highland Street, about 1 mile from Joan's apartment. She awoke to sounds coming from her walk-in closet. As she tried to run from the house, a man grabbed her. She managed to break free and get out of the house, but he captured her again on the front walk, knocked her onto her back, and used his knees to hold her down. He beat and raped her on the walkway, and as Denise continued to fight her attacker, she bit him hard on the inside of his upper right arm. He ran away and escaped back through the house. Denise called the police. She'd also been strangled and severely beaten. A large butcher knife, wrapped in a paper napkin from her kitchen, was found lying on the floor outside of her bedroom. Afterward, understandably, Denise and her husband, who'd been out of town, left their home for a few days. On Wednesday, July 14, 1993, just after 7 in the morning, 47-year-old Jessica Jean Fortney was found dead in her bedroom at the home she shared with her family at 407 North Bryan Street, 2.5 miles from Joan's apartment. She'd been killed while her family slept. Jessica's shorts and underwear were around one of her thighs. Her face was swollen and bruised, with dried blood around her eyes, nose, lips, and neck. There was blood spatter on the wall and furniture. A window on the first floor was open, with no screen in it. Jessica's autopsy revealed that she was killed in the early morning hours by strangulation and blunt trauma. She had over 50 different injuries and had been raped. Blood and bodily fluids from her vaginal swabs matched DNA that would later prove to be Harvey's. During this time in 1993, Harvey also broke into a woman's home and, when he found her asleep with her boyfriend, took the woman's 5-year-old daughter from the child's bedroom instead. He put her face down in a laundry basket where he raped and strangled the little girl. Somehow, she survived. Details about this crime are scarce for privacy reasons. On Sunday, July 18, 1993, 4 days after Jessica's murder, Denise and her husband returned to their home. Around 4 a.m. on Monday morning, Denise heard the back door open, but their new alarm went off and the intruder fled. Denise and the police decided that she would remain in the house with a window open every night and a police officer stationed inside. They believed that the intruder would return. Sure enough, on Saturday, July 31st, 1993, around 1:25 a.m., the tenacious twat entered Denise's home through the front window to find Officer Brian Lewis, who identified himself. The intruder ran to the kitchen and shots were exchanged. Officer Lewis moved toward the bedroom but could hear a commotion in the kitchen. When he went back out, the intruder was gone. He'd escaped by breaking through several glass panels on a wooden door and pushing out the rear storm door. Not sure why he didn't just unlock them, but panic's a funny thing. Approximately 2 hours later, Officer Lewis was called to a local hospital, where a man later identified as Harvey was being treated for fresh, bleeding wounds to both of his arms and legs. He also had a healing scar of a bite mark several weeks old on his upper right arm. That same day, police took blood samples from Harvey and searched his home, where they found a black ski mask and a pair of gloves under the sofa cushions, several drops of blood and a soaked green and purple striped rugby-type shirt in the laundry, additional blood in the bathroom, additional pairs of gloves, including a pair of large black rubber gloves, blood-stained shorts and socks, a pair of black high-tech sneakers in his bedroom, and a loaded .380 semi-automatic handgun in the bedroom closet, which used to belong to the Sam Callies prior to its disappearance sometime before July 31, 1993. The head stamp on the uppermost cartridge in the handgun was identical with that on the empty cartridge casings found at Denise's house earlier that morning. Officer Lewis identified the clothing found at Harvey's house as what the intruder had been wearing, and Denise identified Harvey as her attacker and rapist. Harvey was charged with 6 counts of burglary, 2 counts of attempted homicide, 4 counts of rape, multiple counts of aggravated indecent assault, 3 counts of indecent assault, 2 counts of criminal trespass, 1 count of kidnapping, 1 count of firearms not to be carried without a license, and 3 counts of criminal homicide. He was sentenced to 40 to 80 years for the crimes committed against Denise and Officer Lewis. In November of 1994, a jury found him guilty of 3 murders of the first degree and all of the other offenses relating to the Burghardt, Schmoyer, and Fortney homicides, and he was sentenced to death for each of them. In 1995, he was convicted of raping the 5-year-old girl and sentenced to an additional 57 years. However, in the appeals process, the death sentences for Joan and Charlotte were vacated. That's because, according to court documents, it was improper for the jury to consider the Schmoyer and Fortney homicides in relation to the Burghardt homicide, because they were committed after the Burghardt homicide. Similarly, the Fortney homicide should not have been considered in relation to the Schmoyer homicide, because it was committed after the Schmoyer homicide. Also, the Supreme Court abolished the juvenile death penalty in 2005, so Harvey's death sentence for Joan's murder was reduced to life in prison. But in 2012, the Supreme Court banned automatic life without parole sentences for juveniles, so his sentence for Joan's murder was changed to 35 years to life. Harvey's conviction for Charlotte's murder was commuted to life in prison as part of a deal. Harvey had to waive all his appeal rights so that her family didn't have to go through the horror repeatedly. He's still fighting his remaining death penalty, but faces close to 200 years for rape and other charges of which he was convicted and is currently being held in the State Correctional Institution, Phoenix. Some side notes. It was later established that the pattern design of the bruise on Charlotte's cheek was consistent with the size, design, and wear characteristics of Harvey's sneakers. The same patterns were found on her Walkman. Harvey lived about a quarter mile from Joan's apartment, a half mile from where Charlotte was abducted and 1 mile from where he left her body, a half mile from Denise's home, and 2.25 miles from Jessica's home. But from 1984 to 1986, he'd lived 0.1 miles away. 0.1. That's not even a block. In 1963, Harvey's father, also Harvey Robinson, beat his mistress to death and was sent to prison. Sadly, Denise Sam Calley passed away suddenly on Friday, January 25th, 2021. That's it for today, y'all. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow the show or like the episode, depending on your platform, and leave a rating or review. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, Dimes.